Welcome to the Spiritual Lifestyle Podcast, formerly known as Chapters of Motherhood. I'm your host, Veronica Moss, and I've returned with an evolved vision. I'm currently in studio passionately crafting brand new episodes set to officially debut in the spring of 2024. We now focus on promoting spiritual growth in all areas of life, including career, relationships, and mindful parenting. While you're waiting for the new season to kick off, why not revisit some of the classics? We've got your favorite episodes from Chapters of Motherhood lined up for your enjoyment. So sit back, relax, and let the Spiritual Lifestyle Podcast lead you on a journey of self-discovery and growth. Stay tuned. Welcome to your renewed spiritual sanctuary, the Spiritual Lifestyle Podcast. Welcome to another episode of Chapters of Motherhood. This is your host, Veronica. Today, I am joined with Dr. Susan Vanskoy. She is a child psychologist and an author, and we're here to talk about raising socially confident kids. Welcome, Dr. Susan.
Thank you. So I am the mom of two teenagers, and I live in Iowa with my husband and my kids, and we have the typical busy lifestyle with sports and music and school and being pulled in lots of different directions. I've also been a child psychologist for over 20 years, and I specialize in pediatric psychology, which means I spent several years working at a children's hospital doing inpatient care for kids who have medical conditions or trauma, visits to the emergency room, things like that. And then I also do outpatient psychology, which is typical psychology you might be familiar with, so anxiety, depression, ADHD, those topics. And that's actually where I'm at in my career right now. I'm in an outpatient clinic and do some care for those types of issues. And I'm also a parent coach, and I can talk a little bit more later about why I'm moving in that direction. So today, Veronica wanted me to talk about raising socially confident kids. And my why for that topic, really, in the past 5 years in my practice, I've noticed that there's a large increase in anxiety, and especially social anxiety. And so as I dug into these issues and paid a little closer attention to my patients, I realized that this topic is a little bit sneaky, in that in younger kids, you know, this anxiety typically presents as oppositional behavior and some negativity. And so kids might be referred to me for a behavior problem, but I realized kind of what's lying underneath is anxiety, and especially social anxiety. My son, for example, could fit into that category. So the best example I can remember when he was young is that I was excited to take him to a new frozen yogurt stand, and I picked him up in car line, and he got in, and I was like, you know, guys, we're going to go to a new yogurt stand that's here. And his first words were, "I hate it. Why can't we go back to Gertie's," which was the place that he enjoyed. Now, if I didn't know he was anxious, I would think he was being ornery or a stinker or rude. But I know that he has an anxiety for trying new things and being around new people. And so I realized that that's what was underneath his kind of oppositional behavior at the time. So it ended up being his new favorite, but he did try it. And so that's kind of an example of how younger kids can be oppositional. It can kind of look like anxiety.
Can I ask you, Dr. Yeah. Susan, for example, if I notice that my child is, for a lack of a better word, like being bratty and just doesn't want to do the, like, try out new things and go places, that could be an underlying symptom of social anxiety?
Right. Or even just general anxiety, you know, trying new things. Yeah, I would always
like say, like, wanting to stay home, wanting to be a homebody, not really going out with, even though if it's a play date.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So sometimes that behavior does come across as just being difficult or bratty or oppositional. To me, erring on the side of this could be anxiety always is the more gentle, kind option versus just jumping to, you know, the conclusion that your kid wants to be a jerk that day or that moment. And so not that we all haven't done that many times, but having some empathy and focusing on, you know, maybe this is some type of anxiety, you can get a little bit farther in terms of redirecting their behavior.
Right. Because a lot of the times people think, or like parents think, like, well, you're a little kid. You shouldn't know what it feels like to be embarrassed or to feel anxiety. You're a little kid. So we forget they're little people.
Right.
And they
right.
have big feelings as well. And I know that for me personally, I used to think the same thing with one of my daughters. And I used to think, like, she's too little to feel embarrassed. Like, she started singing Happy Birthday, and we thought it was the cutest thing. We kind of laughed, and she was embarrassed and ran off and was, like, really angry about it. I thought, oh, my gosh, like, I've never seen her act like this before. Mm-hmm. But to me, I couldn't understand it. Like, you know, why are you being embarrassed? You shouldn't be embarrassed right now.
Right. You know, some kids are just hardwired for anxiety, and so their default is going to be, you know, if it makes me feel uncomfortable, it must be dangerous. And so I'm going to freeze, or I'm going to fight, or I'm going to run away. And so in that case, your daughter ran away when she got that negative input, which is, you know, thinking people were laughing at her or doing something at her expense. So, yeah, that's a great example.
Right. And so what would have been a better response? Because we thought it was cute and we were just laughing, but, you know, I didn't realize that she would have gotten embarrassed. So what could I have done different at that point?
Well, you know, I'm thinking not put her in that position again, or, but at the time, I think just going in and encouraging her, you know, to come back out, or helping her, you know, play with some Barbies for a little bit until she can, you know, could kind of rejoin the group, and then making sure people didn't make a big deal about it or revisit it. You know, grandma doesn't say, why did you run away? And we were just, you know, trying to have fun. And often, you know, people go in and chastise their child, you know, everybody came all this way and they're here to help you celebrate. And so definitely avoiding that, and yes, and just acknowledging, you know, I can see that hurt your feelings, or I can see that made you run away. I won't take credit for it, but there's an interesting parenting concept out there called say what you see. And so instead of trying to think of some brilliant thing to say, you just say what you see. And, you know, you would have said, I can see that made you cry. I can tell, you know, I can see that made you run away. And sometimes that just feeling understood can go a long way with a kiddo in terms of, you know, helping them get their back down so they can rejoin a group or listen to you instead of always having to be on the defensive.
All right.
So another reason I became more interested in social confidence in kids was that I had a lot of teenage patients, and their anxiety really manifested as depression. And so really a high percent of the time, a referral would come to me for depression. And as I dug a little deeper, I can't tell you how many times really social anxiety was at the core. And often it went like this. So, you know, in elementary school, you know, the child, boys and girls, they were shy, you know, it was cute. They hung around really extroverted friends who love to take care of them and, you know, love to speak for them, for the teacher, you know. Sarah doesn't want to jump rope because Johnny's bothering her. And they really love that nurturing, that protecting, you know, element of that friendship. And of course, the anxious, you know, child loved it as well because they got to be included and they got to feel protected and they really didn't have to develop their skills. But as the same peer group would hit middle school or high school, and these more extroverted friends kind of started to look for more similar peers, they would actually, you know, leave the socially anxious kiddo behind. I had a, you know, one patient that showed me a text from her friend. I think she was a seventh grader, and it literally said, "You're just too much work." And so I know it's heartbreaking. So the same friend group who she had counted on and who, you know, protected her and enjoyed that role, as they moved on to different things they found valuable in friendships, they left her behind. And so the referral, you know, was about depression, but it really was about completely losing a peer group that she really counted on, because her skills, her, you know, approach to social situations did not keep up. And the older you get, you just get written out of the social stories. You know, they know you won't do sleepovers, so you aren't invited. They know you won't go to sleepaway camp, so you aren't invited. And then you come back after summer and there's all kinds of chatter and fun conversation and you're not a part of it. So between these trends and, you know, my own kids are pretty reserved in their own ways. And so with them getting older too, I really felt compelled to reach out and do a little bit more than I kind of could in my four therapy walls. And so that's when I started on some of these other adventures.
Okay.
So the first thing is I wrote a book, Navigating Negativity, which you can find on Amazon. It's a super quick read, 90 pages with really solid advice for parents on that topic that we talked about earlier, which is really how do you identify anxiety in your kiddo when it's presenting as negativity? You know, how do you set the stage for someone who's really there to listen and to kind of be that credible source of help instead of, you know, always correcting them or getting angry at them? And really the main focus of the book, though, is how you parent kind of every other minute of the day to really build on their strengths. And so they have a little bit more bandwidth because there's a lot more things that go right for them so that they don't have this negative, you know, kind of negative view of life. So just, you know, really accepting and valuing your kids as they are.
Okay. And I can understand that because a lot of the times when parents see their child having a difficulty or problems, even with the friends, you want to go in there and you want to fix it. But we need to learn to not fix it. We need to learn to understand them and help guide them through it.
Right. Okay. You know, one of my favorite pieces of advice is to limit or, you know, change the timing of your reassurance. So, you know, if your child is struggling to enter a birthday party, for example, and all they hear is, you know, look at Johnny's doing it and he's playing with friends. And, you know, all they hear is, wow, and I'm a loser because I can't do what Johnny's doing. Or, you know, you mean to reassure them, but you're just pointing out how clearly they're not doing what all the other kids are doing. And that actually does the opposite of create confidence.
Right.
And then they don't feel heard. You know, all of us, I think, are really good at digging in when we don't feel heard and understood. And so if you keep going on and on about how easy it should be, mostly then to the point of parents getting really frustrated and, you know, well, fine, I'm just trying to help. So figure it out yourself, you know. But the more that child doesn't feel understood, two things are going to happen. They're going to lock and load on their own feelings until you figure it out, or they're just going to stop coming to you for things because you clearly don't understand and, you know, you're not offering them, you know, some space to feel how they're feeling.
Right, right.
Right.
Yeah. I've done that. I've done that also where I'm like, come on, go play. Look at how everybody else is playing. I've learned to change that to, if you're not ready to go play, it's fine. You can sit here until you're ready.
Right.
And usually like within 3 to 5 minutes, they get up and go.
Right. Yeah, it is quite, I mean, it is quite really amazing if you just agree. And whether it's the negativity or just, you know, classic anxiety, if you just agree that it feels like a big problem, if you just agree it seems scary, you know, you can just almost feel the energy change because, you know, your kid just doesn't have anything to fight against. And then they're a little bit more open to, like you said, okay, well, let's try in 3 minutes. They're open to your suggestions because you feel like you're on the same side of the problem instead of, you know, on the other side of the problem, pushing them to do something that feels too scary.
Right. Can we go back to teenagers?
Sure.
Now, how do we know what the, for a parent, how would we know what the difference is between, oh, that's just normal, typical teenage behavior to this looks kind of like depression, kind of like anxiety? How do we decipher that?
It can be really difficult. You know, teenagers can put on a front or put on a face. I mean, part of me wants to say, you know, if it really is starting to impact their life. And so they are losing friends, they're staying home more, they're dropping out of interests, or they're, you know, not signing up for things that they used to enjoy. If they're wanting to spend a lot of time on their own, you know, those are kind of some markers that I would probably watch for as a parent. I mean, typically, you know, teenagers can be moody, but I don't really believe any teenager wants to be in isolation all the time. Okay. And so I say as a parent, you know, continue pushing to spend time, you know, with your kiddo. That's really the only way you're going to lay eyes on them to see, you know, what's going on. Certainly if they're making social media posts of being, you know, depressed or sad, or they're really drawn, you know, to that type of a peer group or an online group, you might watch for those kinds of things. Yeah, not a lot of kids really present as, you know, classic, I'm not showering, I'm giving all my stuff away, or some of those more extreme forms of depression. Often it's subtle. I would always believe your child if they say they're depressed. I know this is going off on, you know, a little bit of a tangent. Depressed or anxious. You know, I have a lot of kids tell me their parents say things like, oh, you don't know what rough is, or, you know, oh, every teenager feels like this. I just, again, everybody wants to feel heard and accepted. And so there's nothing wrong with getting that checked out with a pediatrician or a mental health professional, and not erring on the side of everybody has a rough life. Because even if that's true, I mean, I don't think anyone gets out of adolescence without some emotional bumps and bruises. That's part of its function. But it's the more important message is, I hear you and you're telling me you need help. And whether I believe it's a rough time or not doesn't matter. And then you're teaching your child to also, you know, be open with emotions and to feel free to use resources in the community. So those messages are much more important than, you know, get over it, you're just going through a teenage life.
Right. Okay.
Teenage life is hard these days.
Yes. Yes. I do empathize with my children because I remember what it was like as a teenager. I thought that was hard. So mm-hmm. I do try to empathize with my older kids. Well, they're adults now, but when they were teenagers, I tried as hard as I could to understand them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just don't think there's any downside to that. Because honestly, even getting through typical emotional development as a teenager, everyone could use some support. You know, I certainly yes. could have, you know, would have loved someone to talk to that wasn't my parents. And I see fairly high functioning kids. I live in a community that has really smart parents. And if their kids are struggling, even with just perfectionism or, you know, minor issues, they seek mental health services. And yeah, some of those kids, you know, we tweak their mindset, we tweak their maladaptive thoughts, you know, we tweak their coping skills, introduce them to, you know, relaxation apps, those kinds of things. And then they have a few more tools in their toolkit, as it were, to help them navigate the rest of adolescence. So I think that's important. And then the other thing I did to try to reach more people and make more of an impact is I started a free Facebook group, which is Raising Socially Confident Kids. And I think we're up to about 400 caregivers now from all over the world, popular in Canada for some reason. There's a lot of grandparents in there, parents. And really the main goal is just supporting and encouraging each other as we kind of find ways to, you know, build our kids' social confidence. I mean, not everyone you know, not all of your friends would be super excited or understand, you know, why you're excited because your 14-year-old finally went on a sleepover. But this group understands that. And it's just kind of a safe place to either be a worrier parent and say, you know, I'm really worried about my kid not being able to talk to his teacher because he said he'd rather have an F. Or we have lots of logical parents in there who just absolutely have no idea why their child is anxious, don't understand it at all. And so, yeah, we share small wins and big wins. I have lives in there that kind of teach some tips and things parents can do. Obviously, because it's for the parents, I don't, you know, directly work with kids in that group. But for example, one of my favorite anxiety tips is just changing the dreaded what if to even if. And so that can work great for kids, even, you know, 7, 8 years old. So, you know, well, what if I don't have anybody to sit by at lunch? You know, or what if my friend is sick for lunch? Well, even if your friend is sick at lunch today, you know, you can sit by our neighbor, Sarah, or you could ask your teacher if you could eat in the classroom. Or so it's very empowering just to switch that one little word from, you know, what if to even if. Okay. So I even use that as a adult sometimes. That's just one example of something I would share in the group. So yeah, that's kind of recently we've had a great conversation about, you know, popularity and how that plays into confidence. So right. Yeah, it's a really nice group. It's very supportive and gaining momentum. And part of that is also to help reach people and let them know I've just started to do some individual parent coaching. And so I can reach people across the globe instead of, you know, just here where I live, and really give people that kind of one-on-one support you can't get from a book or blog or, you know, a free Facebook group. So that's my other mission, my other adventure that I've been up to lately.
Okay. And how do you do that? Do you conduct that like through Facebook or phone call or
most people prefer, most people just prefer like a Zoom call or FaceTime. A lot of time it's just a telephone call, so neither one of us have to, you know, get our makeup on or have a clean house. So
right. Okay. Yeah, that sounds great. Now, what other common needs do you see that goes on in the group? I know I participated in the popularity. My son, Adam, when he was in school, he was everybody's best friend. Like, everybody liked him. He was very confident, and he was a popular kid growing up. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, my daughter, my two oldest kids are adults already, right? It's Adam and Leah. And then I have the three younger ones. But my daughter, Leah, complete opposite. She was painfully shy. And I understood her so much because that's how I was when I was growing up. I was painfully shy. I was afraid to talk. I was afraid to raise my hand and answer questions because what if I'm wrong? Mm-hmm. Or I'm right, but, you know, I don't want that attention. So I understood her more than I could understand my son.
mm-hmm. where it was like, oh, wow, you know, he's so popular. He's so everybody's friend. But my listeners know, I don't think you know, but my son was diagnosed ADHD at age 3. And my ex-husband didn't want to give him medication for it. Mm-hmm. So we had to learn how to navigate with his ADHD, the hyperness of it all, mm-hmm. and the emotional bursts of it. But still in school, he was really popular. And I think that's what attracted all the other kids to him, was his energy was just, you know, such a high energy. And he was very kind, very friendly. And at 16, he had a psychotic break. And at 18, he was diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic and bipolar. So when that happened, it blew my mind, because it wasn't how he grew up. You know what I mean? He was mm-hmm. very confident. He was very friendly. You know, everybody, he could make friends with a 1-year-old as well as a 90-year-old.
Right.
You know? And so my worry was always, growing up, was always Leah, my daughter, mm-hmm. because she was just painfully shy, and I didn't know how to help her out of that. And I did do the chastising, like, go out and play. You're going to, you know, miss your years, you know, go do it. And I just didn't know how to help guide her. And now that I have these next 3 kids, which is 9, 5, and 3, all girls, completely different parenting style. I'm more, I think I have like that grandma mentality where it's like, it's okay, let them do what they're going to do. You know, just make sure they don't hurt themselves. And, you know, if you want to go out and play, you can. If you don't, you can stay in here if you want. You know, very different mentality. So what other common needs do you see in the group that people bring up?
Right. You know, I think the main one is just what you're talking about is, and there is no magic answer, you know, how do you know when to nudge, and how do you know when to nurture, and, you know, not constantly second guess, you know, should I have forced that sleepover? Should I have, you know, forced her to go play outside? I think the marathon perspective is, you know, I mean, some of the conversation about popularity is that, you know, your kids like ability way outweighs, you know, the status things that come in junior high and high school, whether that's, you know, their athletic prowess or how smart they are or whatever's valued in your school or school district or, you know, your community. And so I tend to err on the side of, you know, of more of the nurturing and, you know, possibly enabling a little bit, but I just think it's a kinder path. And so, you know, if your child needs a little more time, you know, there's no magic that says you have to master sleepovers by 12 years old, or I think I was like 8th grade before I could comfortably stay overnight. But then went on to, you know, move to California by myself for grad school and went on leadership, you know, trips in high school. And so there is some conversation about, you know, is this a time I should push? Is this a time I shouldn't? And, you know, a lot of work I do in coaching and in therapy is really, first of all, giving parents permission to not work on stinking everything, you know. You don't have to work on ordering for yourself and making eye contact with grandma and, you know, talking to the teacher and, you know, walking into school on your own. And so one of the things we do just to make it more palatable is just to get rid of, just say for the next 6 months, I'm not going to ask her to order for herself at Chick-fil-A. I'm just going to do it, knowing that she'll work on it later. And sometimes you can get some good progress that way, just knowing you don't have to work on everything. And then, you know, focusing more on building what your kiddo is good at. If they're great talking to little kids, they're still building some of those social skills, those likability skills. Just because it's not their peers doesn't mean they're not building those skills. So those are some of the conversations we have in the group and, you know, in therapy and in coaching, is focusing on, you know, what do you work on and what baby steps do you take? Because we're all, you know, it's interesting. I mean, why do you think gaming and video games and all that are so successful? It's because those developers are masters at how do you just, you know, push a kid just a little bit, you know, so they can master it and they can win the level and they can get the bells and whistles and they move on to the next thing. It gets the kid hooked. And so if you can approach some of these developmental tasks that way, you won't get the pushback that maybe you get when you're being too critical or you're pushing too hard. But, you know, it's nice too if you can have a reality check from, you know, a caring co-partner or, you know, friend or even this group where you do need to push a little bit more and, you know, maybe where you are, you know, kind of because of your own anxiety, maybe holding back on your, you know, your kiddo a little bit. And so.
Well, you bring something up that I was actually going to ask you a question on. What about the anxious parent?
Right.
How, you know, as an anxious parent, are you raising an anxious child? Or, because sometimes I see the opposite where, you know, the anxious parent has this outgoing child and the child is doing everything for the parent.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So how is this a good group for an anxious parent to join as well?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's, and again, I would say of the two types of parents, you know, the more anxious versus logical, I definitely run on the anxious, side. My daughter had a scary medical incident and there was a window of time where it still could come back at any time. And so I know for several months, I was the one that, I'll just go with you to that, you know, volleyball practice, or why don't you just have your friends stay here? Because I was terrified of her having another event. You know, she and I were the only two that were ever around when they happened. And so, you know, she wanted to be more independent long before I wanted her to be independent. And I had to kind of do a reality check and say, you know, she's safe. The other adults that she's going to visit know what to do if this happens again. And so I had to, like, you know, let go of that as well. But that was scary. So what I would hope for anxious parents is for them to maybe, I guess, own up to or realize when maybe it's their own anxiety that's getting in the way.
Right. Now, I bring that up also because my husband is a very anxious parent. And he wants to be very protective and he's very nurturing, very protective. But sometimes it's overprotection. And right. I have to tell him, like, babe, don't you think that this is probably because of your own anxiety when you were a child?
Right.
And he tells me, well, yeah, maybe. And I go, okay, so then we shouldn't do that to the kids, you know, like real quick, easy example. Like he buys a lot of ice cream and cookies and treats for the kids. And he'll tell me it's because his mom didn't buy all these treats for him. It was everything was salty and chili. We're Mexican, so he enjoys, you know, chili candy.
Right.
So he, on the flip side, it's like, you don't think you're a little overboard? You went out and bought two bags full of ice cream. Right. And he's like, I don't think that's overboard. I'm like, I think it is.
Right.
Coming from a child that was spoiled by her daddy.
All right.
That's overboard, even, you know, by my standards.
Right. Yeah.
And so I'm having difficulty trying to get him to understand, like, the baby can walk all over the house if she wants to because she's playing. And he thinks, like, oh, no, she's being neglected. I'm like, she's not being neglected. I'm right here. So I don't know how to reel him in where it's like, let's not project and do these to the kids, because now it's a flip side.
Right. Right. Well, if I could fix husbands, I'd be a rich woman. But
right.
But my comment to that is sometimes, you know, you have to take your, I guess, your prioritize your complaints on that issue too. You know, sometimes an exercise I have caregivers do who are in disagreement is, I call it the 10-year plan. And I guess I forgot, I actually have a parenting book I wrote like 10 years ago, but that's one of the premises. But you basically, you know, separately, you write out what kind of a kid you want, you know, to see 10 years from now. So 13, 23, you know, and what skills and what do you want, you know, his or her life to look like? And, well, I want her to be independent and, you know, and I want her to stand up for herself and I want her to have good friends. And then you just look at what you're doing to see if that's getting your kiddo there. You know, if you want your kiddo to be able to handle failure and stand up again, then you have to let him fail.
Mm-hmm.
You have to let him fall down. You have to let him make a bad choice about a friendship or, you know, eating too much ice cream. And so sometimes that can help, mostly dads, you know, kind of see, is this behavior really getting me to that destination? Or is it just more about an instant gratification or, you know, kind of filling a gap that I have? You know, for me, my parents got divorced when I was 12. The typical, my mom had to work a lot of jobs. And so I really raised, you know, myself quite a bit and my little sister when I was a teenager. And so I don't want my kids to ever, you know, not feel like I'm there for all their practices and all their events and picture taking for this and that. And as they're getting older, I realize that sometimes I go overboard on that and they will be just fine if I don't make it to a basketball game or, you know, or an event, if it's sacrificing, you know, too much of what I need to get done for myself. So, but that's a, check and balance I have to have with myself all the time. So I think a lot of us are victims of our past, I guess. But knowledge is power, and, you know, hopefully he'll listen to you, and kind of having a spouse with a different experience can help you, I guess, meet in the middle.
Yes. Yes. I think that's our compromise. Like, we got to meet in the middle. Like,
right. Right.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately, you know, what often happens is when one parent goes too far one way, then the other parent goes too far the other way to try to compensate. So if one parent's too giving, then the other one's too restrictive.
Right. Work either.
Right. And, you know, I mean, anything learning wise, you have to have repeated opportunities. So if you're trying to learn two systems for a kiddo, they're, you know, it's twice as hard.
Now, speaking of which, how do we make sure that they're confident with themselves individually? Like, I know I can't raise my 3-year-old the way I raised my 23-year-old, right?
Right.
So it has to be individual. What do you recommend on seeing the child as an individual?
I guess just really honestly creating opportunities for them to develop what they're good at. And so, you know, kids have different personalities. I have one that's the classic good at sports and, you know, a great relator to teachers and super kind to little kids. And so, you know, I might develop different things in her. My son, he's also kind with little kids, but he's more of he loves science and he loves art and he loves, you know, he just connects in different ways. And so, you know, for a while we send him to private school where those things were more nurtured than they are in public school. Whereas my daughter fit the typical, you know, the classic smart, good student, you know, model. And so I think really just taking the time to listen, you know, to what your kids like and want and developing those. You know, interestingly, when I was writing my book, the editor of my book, I came, you know, she was editing the part of the book that talks about that, like, you know, don't develop your kid into what you hope they'll be, you know, focus on what they really like. And she said she was an avid reader and she always asked for books for Christmas, but her parents would never get her books. They would get her sports equipment or a ticket to a play or something like that, but they never gave her books. And so she just felt disregarded in that way and kind of lost confidence in the things that she believed in. And then ironically became a book editor later. But so that's just an example of, you know, if they just would have shared my love of reading and, you know, read chapter books together or things like that, I would have felt more confident that the thing that I liked was worth some value.
Right. Okay. So. Yeah. And then on the other hand, there are parents that have the sports kid and they want them to be more book study.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
So it's better to focus on what they enjoy and what brings out the best in them.
Right. And I'm not sure we're always honest with ourselves about, you know, why we promote or discourage certain things. And so I think, again, having an honest look at, you know, why do you really want your kid to play 8 sports or, you know, play an instrument or go out for a band or, but the struggle too is, I get it, you know, when you have a really reserved kiddo that everything new is scary, you have to nudge and say, well, you have to at least try this 3 times. At our house, it's, you can't quit because of fear. You can, you know, quit or not do it another season if you've played and you really have some data to back up the reason why you don't want to do it. You know, my son plays volleyball and he didn't want to play a new position and that's stupid. And everybody, you know, picks on you if that's the, you know, position you play and I don't want to do that. And well, you have to do what your coach says this one time. And like most things that he is anxious about, I love it. I hope I get to play this every single game, you know, And I, you know, it's not hard anymore, but in the beginning, they'd have to work very hard at not saying, you know, see, I told you so, and look how much you hated it, and now you love it. And now we just agree with him, like, he thought of the idea, you know, because that works much better, you know. If I say it, you have to fight against it. If you say it, then you believe it, you know, is another mantra to remember in parenting. So we let him think it was his idea and that it was awesome that it turned out great. So, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Susan. So if my listeners wanted to find you, and definitely I do recommend you join the group if you are on Facebook, where can we find you?
So in the group, you can just search groups for Raising Socially Confident Kids, or you can email me directly at susan@myconfidencecoach.com. And again, my book is on Amazon. Just Google Navigating Negativity, and there's a grumpy girl on the cover that you'll notice.
It's a cute girl.
And yeah. And I guess I should mention one more thing about my book, which I think is awesome, which all the strategies and things that I talk about in there, there's actually requires no cooperation from your kids whatsoever. So I know plenty of parenting books where people get stuck because, you know, their child won't cooperate with the strategy, but these are all for parents. And so no kids have to cooperate at all. So that's kind of a nice feature that will get you farther than some other books. And I do want to give a free book to one of your listeners. And so I thought maybe if they join the Facebook group and they message me that they came from this podcast, then I will draw for a free book at the end of the month.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm sure my listeners will definitely appreciate it. I'll link everything in the show notes. And that sounds great. Mention that you heard her on the podcast. And
right.
And that sounds wonderful. Yeah.
Great. Well, I look forward to having some of your listeners join us. And I really appreciate the opportunity to chat about my mission here.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Dr. Susan. I know it was difficult to make some time for me, but I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Veronica.